The following is an Audio Renaissance presentation.
Hello, I'm Bill Hartley, president of Audio Renaissance, and I'm pleased to introduce you to our presentation of Zen Practice, Zen Art, based on materials from the book The Way of Zen by Alan W. Watts. On this cassette, you'll hear not only excerpts from The Way of Zen, read by Ralph Blum, but also, from time to time, you'll hear rare recordings of Alan Watts himself, recorded in seminar, elaborating on certain points from the book. If you've already heard our tape entitled The Way of Zen, this program will give you a greater understanding of the history of Zen and will familiarize you with the way that Zen is studied in Japan today. If this is your first Audio Renaissance Alan Watts tape, please be assured, it's not necessary to have heard The Way of Zen first. This tape is complete unto itself, either as an introduction to Zen or as fresh insights into the study of Zen from one of the world's most knowledgeable authorities. And now, may I introduce you to Zen Practice, Zen Art.
Western thought has changed so rapidly in this century that we are in a state of considerable confusion. Familiar concepts of space, time, and motion, of nature and natural law, of history and social change, of human personality itself, have dissolved, and we find ourselves adrift without landmarks in a universe which more and more resembles the Buddhist principle of the Great Void. The various wisdoms of the West, religious, philosophical, and scientific, do not offer much guidance to the art of living in such a universe, and we find the prospects of making our way in so trackless an ocean of relativity rather frightening. For we are used to absolutes, to firm principles and laws to which we can cling for spiritual and psychological security. That may be why there is so much interest in a culturally productive way of life, which, for some 1,500 years, has felt thoroughly at home in the void, and which not only feels no terror for it, but rather a positive delight. To use its own words, the situation of Zen has always been, above, not a tile to cover the head. Below, not an inch of ground for the foot. But the scientifically trained Westerner is a cautious and skeptical fellow who likes to know what he is getting into. This tape does not advocate importing Zen from the Far East, for there it has become deeply involved with cultural institutions which are quite foreign to us. But there is no doubt that there are things which we can learn or unlearn from Zen and apply in our own way. Historically, Zen may be regarded as the fulfillment of long traditions of Indian and Chinese culture, though it is actually much more Chinese than Indian, and, since the 12th century, it has rooted itself deeply and most creatively in the culture of Japan. It is not a religion or philosophy. It is not a psychology or a type of science. It is rather an example of what is known in India and China as a way of liberation, and is as much Taoist as Buddhist.
Zen is a translation of the Sanskrit word jhana, pronounced chan in Chinese and zen in Japanese. It is unfortunately untranslatable in English. It designates a certain state of consciousness that is sometimes called meditation, but that won't do at all. Contemplation isn't really the point. And sometimes one-pointedness of mind. I would prefer to translate this word with the notion of total presence of mind. When we say a person is crazy, we often say they're not all there. Now go to the opposite of that and visualize a person who is completely there or who is completely here. A person who lives totally and absolutely now. That doesn't mean he's incapable of thinking about the past or the future, because thoughts about the past and about the future are included in the present. You have them now. But imagine the kind of person who is not distracted, who when he talks to you, really gives you his whole being. The Tao is a way of life. The word Tao means the way, the course of nature, the flow of things. And in order to understand this point of view, we have to make a very, very radical adjustment in our ordinary common sense. Because Zen and Taoism in common involve not a system of doctrine, not a set of beliefs as we ordinarily understand religion. They involve a transformation of your consciousness. That is to say, of the way in which you experience your own existence at every moment. One might say that the average individual, not only in the West but also in the East, has a feeling of himself as separate from his surroundings, from other people, and from the earth itself, and from the space and the stars and everything around the earth. He feels this in such a way that it's expressed in all the phrases of common speech. We talk about coming into the world. I came into this world. As a matter of fact, you didn't. You came out of it. Just in the same way as an apple comes out of an apple tree, as an expression of the apple tree. The world that we live in and we experience is not cut up into things and events. It all goes together in the same way that the bees and the flowers go together, only we don't notice this. We've got a way of thinking which splits it all up, and as a result of that, we think of ourselves, and so feel ourselves, as if we were something separate from the whole domain of nature. And to make a long story short, and to tell you the whole point right at the beginning, the disciplines of Taoism and of Zen propose to change your consciousness in such a way that you will no longer feel that you are an isolated unit locked up inside a bag of skin, but that you will actually experience the fact that your real self, the real you, is everything that there is, but concentrated and expressing itself at the point called your physical organism. We as individual organisms, as what we call physical bodies, we come and go like leaves on a tree, but there's the tree. And you are the tree. In the saying of Jesus, I am the vine, you are the branches. But that I am, before Abraham was I am, is the self, and is what the Hindus call the Brahman, and the Chinese call the Tao.
The Indian Buddhist origins of Zen. Fundamental to the life and thought of India from the very earliest times is the great mythological theme of self-sacrifice, whereby God gives birth to the world, and whereby men, following the divine pattern, reintegrate themselves with God. As Prajapati, Vishnu or Brahma, the Lord under many names, creates the world by an act of self-dismemberment or self-forgetting, whereby the one becomes many, and the single actor plays innumerable parts. The thousand heads, eyes, and feet of the Purusha are the members of the human race and other beings. For the point is that that which knows, in and through every individual, is God himself, the Atman or self of the world. Every life is a part or role in which the mind of God is absorbed, somewhat as an actor absorbs himself in being Hamlet and forgets that in real life he is Mr. Smith. By the act of self-abandonment, God becomes all beings. It is important to remember that this picture of the world as the play, Lila, of God is mythological in form. According to the myth, the divine play goes on through endless cycles of time, through periods of manifestation and withdrawal of the worlds. The foregoing myth is not the expression of a formal philosophy, but of an experience or state of consciousness which is called moksha, or liberation. It may be considered as the discovery of who or what I am, when I am no longer identified with any role or conventional definition of my person. Indian philosophy does not describe the content of this discovery except in mythological terms, using the phrase, I am Brahman, or "That art thou," to suggest that self-knowledge is a realization of one's original identity with God. Moksha is also understood as liberation from Maya, one of the most important words in Indian philosophy, both Hindu and Buddhist. The manifold world of facts and events is said to be Maya. To say, then, that the world of facts and events is Maya is to say that facts and events are terms of measurement rather than realities of nature. This point of view is somewhat startling and even quite hard to understand for those long accustomed to think that things, facts, and events are the very building blocks of the world, the most solid of solid realities. Yet a proper understanding of the Maya doctrine is one of the most essential prerequisites for the study of Buddhism. Buddhists prefer to speak of reality as non-dual rather than one, since the concept of one must always be in relation to that of many. The doctrine of Maya is therefore a doctrine of relativity. It is saying that things, facts, and events are delineated not by nature, but by human description, and that the way in which we describe or divide them is relative to our varying points of view. In summary, then, the Maya doctrine points out, first, the impossibility of grasping the actual world in the mind's net of words and concepts, and second, the fluid character of those very forms which thought attempts to define. The world of facts and events is altogether nama, abstract names, and rupa, fluid form. It escapes both the comprehension of the philosopher and the grasp of the pleasure seeker, like water from a clutching fist. It is precisely this realization of the total elusiveness of the world which lies at the root of Buddhism. This is the special shift of emphasis which, more than anything else, distinguishes the doctrine of the Buddha from the teaching of the Upanishads. Gautama, the awakened one, or Buddha, lived at a time when the major Upanishads were already in existence. That was in the 6th century, and their philosophy must be seen as the point of departure for his own teaching. For 7 years, Gautama had struggled by the traditional means of yoga and tapas, contemplation and asceticism, to penetrate the cause of man's enslavement to Maya, to find release from the vicious circle of clinging to life, Trishna, which is like trying to make the hand grasp itself. All his efforts had been in vain. The eternal Atman, the real self, was not to be found. However much he concentrated upon his own mind to find its root and ground, he found only his own effort to concentrate. The evening before his awakening, he simply gave up, relaxed his ascetic diet, and ate some nourishing food. Thereupon, he felt at once that a profound change was coming over him. He sat beneath the bow tree, vowing never to rise until he had attained the supreme awakening, and according to a tradition, sat all through the night until the first glimpse of the morning star suddenly provoked a state of perfect clarity and understanding. This was his Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, unexcelled, complete awakening, liberation from Maya and from the everlasting round of birth and death, samsara, which goes on and on for as long as a man tries in any way whatsoever to grasp at his own life. The Buddha set forth his doctrine in the form of 4 noble truths. The first truth is concerned with the problematic word dukkha, loosely translatable as suffering, which designates the great disease of the world, for which the Buddha's method, dharma, is the cure. This, however, cannot be compressed into the sweeping assertion that life is suffering. The point is rather that life as we usually live it is suffering, or more exactly, is bedeviled by the peculiar frustration which comes from attempting the impossible. Perhaps then, frustration is the best equivalent of dukkha. The second noble truth relates to the cause of frustration, which is said to be trishna, clinging, or grasping, based on avidya, which is ignorance or unconsciousness. Now, avidya is the formal opposite of awakening. It is the state of the mind when hypnotized or spellbound by Maya, so that it mistakes the abstract world of things and events for the concrete world of reality. At a still deeper level, it is the lack of self-knowledge, lack of the realization that all grasping turns out to be the futile effort to grasp oneself, or rather, to make life catch hold of itself. The third noble truth is concerned with the ending of self-frustration, of grasping, and of the whole viciously circular pattern of karma which generates the round. The ending of karma is called nirvana. Nirvana could be described as despiration. It is the act of one who has seen the futility of trying to hold his breath or life, prana, indefinitely, since to hold the breath is to lose it. Thus, nirvana is the equivalent of moksha, release or liberation. Nirvana is the way of life which ensues when clutching at life has come to an end. To attain nirvana is also to attain Buddhahood, awakening. But this is not attainment in any ordinary sense, because no acquisition and no motivation are involved. It is impossible to desire nirvana, or to intend to reach it, for anything desirable or conceivable as an object of action is, by definition, not nirvana. Nirvana can only arise unintentionally, spontaneously, when the impossibility of self-grasping has been thoroughly perceived. The fourth noble truth describes the eightfold path of the Buddha's Dharma, that is, the method or doctrine whereby self-frustration is brought to an end. The first two sections have to do with thought, the following four have to do with action, and the final two to do with contemplation or awareness. The four sections dealing with action are often misunderstood because they have a deceptive similarity to a system of morals. Buddhism does not share the Western view that there is a moral law enjoined by God or by nature, which it is one's duty to obey. The Buddha's precepts of conduct, abstinence from taking life, taking what is not given, exploitation of the passions, lying and intoxication, are voluntarily assumed rules of expediency, the intent of which is to remove the hindrances to clarity, to awareness. Failure to observe the precepts produces bad karma, not because karma is a law or moral retribution, but because all motivated and purposeful actions, whether conventionally good or bad, are karma insofar as they are directed to the grasping of life. Generally speaking, the conventionally bad actions are rather more grasping than the good. But the higher stages of Buddhist practice are as much concerned with disentanglement from good karma as from bad. Thus, complete action is ultimately free, uncontrived, or spontaneous action, in exactly the same sense as the Taoist Wu Wei.
This means not to force things. That's the best English translation I've come to. It's sometimes translated not doing, no artificiality, no interference. But our word forcing, as when a forced laugh, forcing a lock, forced behavior, forced kindness, forced love, in that sense forcing, don't force it. So it means action in accordance with the character of the moment and of the circumstances in which you're acting. You see, you can't not interfere with the world. Everything you do interferes with your environment. To know things is to change them. You cannot not interfere. So the idea is to learn how to interfere skillfully. That's the meaning of Wu Wei.
Smriti, recollectedness, and samadhi, contemplation, constitute the section dealing with the life of meditation, the inner, mental practice of the Buddha's way. Complete recollectedness is a constant awareness or watching of one's sensations, feelings, and thoughts, without purpose or comment. It is a total clarity and presence of mind, actively passive, wherein events come and go like reflections on a mirror. Nothing is reflected except what is. Through such awareness, it is seen that the separation of the thinker from the thought, the knower from the known, the subject from the object, is purely abstract. There is not the mind on the one hand and its experiences on the other. There is just a process of experiencing in which there is nothing to be grasped as an object and no one as a subject to grasp it. Seen thus, the process of experiencing ceases to clutch at itself, Thought follows thought without interruption, that is, without any need to divide itself from itself, so as to become its own object. The non-duality of the mind, in which it is no longer divided against itself, is samadhi. And because of the disappearance of that fruitless threshing around of the mind to grasp itself, samadhi is a state of profound peace. This is not the stillness of total inactivity, for once the mind returns to its natural state, samadhi persists at all times, in walking, standing, sitting, and lying. But from the earliest times, Buddhism has especially emphasized the practice of recollectedness and contemplation while sitting. Most images of the Buddha show him in the posture of sitting meditation, the posture of the lotus, with the legs crossed and the feet resting, soles upward, upon the thighs. Sitting meditation is not, as is often supposed, a spiritual exercise, a practice followed for some ulterior object. From a Buddhist standpoint, it is simply the proper way to sit, and it seems perfectly natural to remain sitting so long as there is nothing else to be done, and so long as one is not consumed with nervous agitation. To the restless temperament of the West, sitting meditation may seem to be an unpleasant discipline, because we do not seem to be able to sit, just to sit, without qualms of conscience, without feeling that we ought to be doing something more important to justify our existence. Because the teaching of the Buddha was a way of liberation, it had no other object than the experience of nirvana. The Buddha did not attempt to set forth a consistent philosophical system, trying to satisfy that intellectual curiosity about ultimate things which expects answers in words. When pressed for such answers, when questioned about the nature of nirvana, the origin of the world, and the reality of the self, the Buddha maintained a noble silence, and went on to say that such questions were irrelevant and did not lead to the actual experience of liberation. It has often been said that the later development of Buddhism was due to the inability of the Indian mind to rest content with that silence, so that at last it had to indulge its overwhelming urge for abstract metaphysical speculations about the nature of reality. There are two sets of Buddhist scriptures, the Pali Canon of the Southern School of Buddhism, which flourishes in Ceylon, Burma, and Thailand, and the Sanskrit-Tibetan-Chinese Canon of the Mahayana, or Northern School. The vast body of Mahayana doctrine arose not so much to satisfy intellectual curiosity as to deal with the practical psychological problems encountered in following the Buddha's way. Certainly the treatment of these problems is highly scholastic, and the intellectual level of the Mahayana texts is very lofty. But the consistent aim is to bring about the experience of liberation, not to construct a philosophical system. The great concern of the Mahayana is the provision of skillful means, upaya, for making nirvana accessible to every type of mentality. These skillful means range from the sophisticated dialectic of Nagarjuna, whose object is to free the mind of all fixed conceptions, to the Pure Land doctrine of liberation through simply repeating the name of Amitabha. They even include the Tantric Buddhism of medieval India, where liberation may be realized through the repetition of sacred words and formulae called dharani, and through special types of yoga involving sexual intercourse with a shakti, or spiritual wife. No one has been able to find any trace of a specific dhyana school in Indian Buddhism. However, it is not really necessary to suppose that there was ever a specific dhyana school in India. The creation of Zen would seem to be sufficiently explained by the exposure of Taoists and Confucians to the main principles of Mahayana Buddhism. Therefore, the appearance of trends very close to Zen can be seen almost as soon as the great Mahayana Sutras became available in China.
Buddhism came to China about the year 400. A very great Sanskrit scholar by the name of Kumarajiva came and started teaching Chinese scholars Sanskrit. Slowly then, Indian attitudes began to be modified by Chinese attitudes because the Chinese read into these translations Taoist meanings. So things got a little altered. So Chinese Zen is the preeminent expression of this because it is the mixture of Indian Buddhism and Chinese Taoism plus a certain Confucian practicality. shortly before 500, as the dates now check out, another Indian came to China whose name was Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma was the person who touched off Zen as a specific movement. Bodhidharma had a pupil by the name of Eka. The story is that when Eka came to Bodhidharma, Bodhidharma refused to accept him as a student. All Zen masters do this. They reject you. And this stimulates you, you see, to come back stronger. If you're going to learn at all. And Eka came back stronger and stronger and stronger, and Bodhidharma resisted him stronger and stronger, and finally he cut off his left arm and presented it to Bodhidharma and said, look, here's my left arm given to you as a token that nothing in the world matters to me except to find out what you're all about. All right, he said, what do you want to know? Eka said, I have no peace of mind. Please pacify my mind. In Chinese, mind is this word pronounced shin. And shin is here. Shin is the heart mind. It's the psychic center. And so Bodhidharma said, bring out your shin here before me and I will pacify it. Eka said, when I look for it, I can't find it. Bodhidharma said, then it's pacified. And Eka immediately understood what all the thing was about. That's the experience called Satori in Japanese, Wu in Chinese, Mandarin, and in the Cantonese dialect, just what we call in our modern psychological jargon the aha phenomenon. The aha phenomenon. Aha! Now I see.
Perhaps the special flavor of Zen is best described as a certain directness. In other schools of Buddhism, awakening or bodhi seems remote and almost superhuman, something to be reached only after many lives of patient effort. But in Zen, there is always the feeling that awakening is something quite natural, something startlingly obvious, which may occur at any moment. If it involves a difficulty, it is just that it is much too simple. Zen is also direct in its way of teaching, for it points directly and openly to the truth and does not trifle with symbolism. Direct pointing, qi qi, is the open demonstration of Zen by non-symbolic actions or words, which usually appear to the uninitiated as having to do with the most ordinary secular affairs, or to be completely crazy. In answer to a question about Buddhism, the master makes a casual remark about the weather, or performs some simple action which seems to have nothing to do with philosophical or spiritual matter. Much of the difficulty and mystification which Zen presents to the Western student is the result of his unfamiliarity with Chinese ways of thinking. In English, the differences between things and actions are clearly, if not always logically, distinguished. But a great number of Chinese words do duty for both nouns and verbs, so that one who thinks in Chinese has little difficulty in seeing that objects are also events, that our world is a collection of processes rather than entities. It is not easy to say why we must communicate with others, speak, and with ourselves, think, by this one-at-a-time method. Life itself does not proceed in this cumbersome, linear fashion, and our own organisms could hardly live for a moment if they had to control themselves by taking thought of every breath, every beat of the heart, and every neural impulse. But if we are to find some explanation for this characteristic of thought, the sense of sight offers a suggestive analogy. For we have two types of vision, central and peripheral, not unlike the spotlight and the floodlight. Central vision is used for accurate work like reading, in which our eyes are focused on one small area after another like spotlights. Peripheral vision is less conscious, less bright than the intense ray of the spotlight. We use it for seeing at night and for taking subconscious notice of objects and movements not in the direct line of central vision. Unlike the spotlight, it can take in very many things at a time. We are not suggesting that Westerners simply do not use the peripheral mind. Being human, we use it all the time, and every artist, every workman, every athlete calls into play some special development of its powers. But it is not academically and philosophically respectable. When we turn to ancient Chinese society, we find two philosophical traditions playing complementary parts, Confucianism and Taoism. According to tradition, the originator of Taoism, Lao Tse, was an older contemporary of Confucius. Lao Tse is said to have been the author of the Tao Te Ching, a short book of aphorisms setting forth the principles of the Tao and its power of virtue, Te. But traditional Chinese philosophy ascribes both Taoism and Confucianism to a still earlier source, to a work which lies at the very foundation of Chinese thought and culture, dating anywhere from 3000 to 1200 BC. This is the I Ching, the Book of Changes. The I Ching is ostensibly a book of divination. It consists of oracles based on 64 abstract figures, each of which is composed of 6 lines. The lines are of 2 kinds, divided, or negative, and undivided, or positive. And the 6-line figures, or hexagrams, are believed to have been based on the various ways in which a tortoise shell will crack when heated. But an expert in the I Ching need not necessarily use tortoise shells or yarrow stalks. He can see a hexagram in anything, in the chance arrangement of a bowl of flowers, in objects scattered upon a table, in the natural markings on a pebble. A modern psychologist will recognize in this something not unlike a Rorschach test, in which the psychological condition of a patient is diagnosed from the spontaneous images that the patient sees in a complex inkblot. On the other hand, we feel that we decide rationally because we base our decisions on collecting relevant data about the matter in hand. We do not depend upon such irrelevant trifles as the chance tossing of a coin or the patterns of tea leaves or cracks in a shell. We go through the motions of gathering the necessary information in a rational way, and then, just because of a hunch or because we are tired of thinking or because the time has come to decide, we act. By far the greater part of our important decisions depend upon hunch, in other words, upon the peripheral vision of the mind. Thus, the reliability of our decisions rests ultimately upon our ability to feel the situation, upon the degree to which this peripheral vision has been developed. Every exponent of the I Ching knows this. He knows that the book itself does not contain an exact science, but rather a useful tool which will work for him if he has a good intuition, or if, as he would say, he is in the Tao. The I Ching had given the Chinese mind some experience in arriving at decisions spontaneously, decisions which are effective to the degree that one knows how to let one's mind alone, trusting it to work by itself. This is Wu Wei, since Wu means not or non, and Wei means action, making, doing, striving, straining, or busyness. To return to the illustration of eyesight, the peripheral vision works most effectively, as in the dark, when we see out of the corners of the eyes and do not look at things directly. Similarly, when we need to see the details of a distant object, such as a clock, the eyes must be relaxed, not staring, not trying to see. So, too, no amount of working with the muscles of the mouth and tongue will enable us to taste our food more acutely. The eyes and the tongue must be trusted to do the work by themselves. The mental or psychological equivalent of this is the special kind of stupidity to which Lao Tse and Chuanzi so often refer. It is not simply calmness of mind, but non-graspingness of mind. Wu Xin, literally, no mind, which is to say, unself-consciousness. It is a state of wholeness in which the mind functions freely and easily.
It has been well said that Buddhism is Hinduism stripped for export. So one might say simply this to try and sum up what Buddhism is about. The word Buddha is derived from the root bud in Sanskrit, B-U-D-H, which means to be awake. So the Buddha is the awakened man, the man who woke up. What does he wake up from? Obviously a dream. And what kind of a dream is this? Well, I would call it a state of hypnosis. And this state of hypnosis, although I'm using hypnosis in a rather archaic sense of the word, is a state of being entranced, spellbound, fascinated, and this is called in Sanskrit avidya. When we were hypnotized into the notion of attending to life by conscious attention alone, by the spotlight to the exclusion of the floodlight. And so we began to imagine that we were separate individuals. What is called in Buddhism Sakkaya Drishti, the view of separateness. And a Buddha is one who has overcome that. So the method of Buddhism, what's called the Dharma, doesn't mean the law, it means the method. The method is to knock the stuffing out of you, to take away everything to which you cling, to cleanse you completely of all beliefs, all ideas, all concepts of what life is about, so that you are completely let go. So Buddhism has no doctrines at all that you have to believe in. I don't care what background you come from, whether you're a Roman Catholic or at one extreme or a logical positivist at the other. Both are clinging to something, you see? And so the method of Buddhism is to knock out the underpinnings and say, well, not only do we not believe in anything, we don't even believe in not believing in anything. So this is what Buddhism does. When it says it's the art of let go, of non-attachment. Non-attachment doesn't mean that you lose your appetite for dinner. It means simply that you stop grabbing. Zen developed in China after Bodhidharma's time and came to a sort of golden age in the Tang and Sung dynasties.
In the year 845, there was a brief but vigorous persecution of Buddhism by the Taoist emperor Wu Tsung. Temples and monasteries were destroyed, lands confiscated, and the monks compelled to return to lay life. Fortunately, his enthusiasm for Taoist alchemy soon involved him in experiments with the elixir of immortality, and from partaking of this concoction, he shortly died. Zen had survived the persecution better than any other school, and now entered a long era of imperial and popular favor. Hundreds of monks thronged its wealthy monastic institutions, and the fortunes of the school so prospered and its numbers so increased that the preservation of its spirit became a very serious problem. The solution was the system of the Kung-an, Japanese koan, or Zen problem. Literally, this term means a public document, or case, in the sense of a decision creating a legal precedent. Thus, the koan system involves passing a series of tests based on the mondo, or anecdotes, of the old masters. The Rinzai school has always forbidden the publication of formally acceptable answers to the various koans, because the whole point of the discipline is to discover them for oneself by intuition. To know the answers without having so discovered them would be like studying the map without taking the journey. Lacking the actual shock of recognition, the bare answers seem flat and disappointing, and obviously no competent master would be deceived by anyone who gave them without genuine feeling. The study of Zen in the Rinzai school proceeds through 6 stages. The first 5 stages consist of passing a graduated series of approximately 50 koan problems. The 6th stage is a study of the Buddhist precepts and the regulations of the monk's life, Vinaya, in the light of Zen understanding. Normally, this course of training takes about 30 years. By no means all Zen monks complete the whole training. This is required only of those who are to receive their master's inca, or seal of approval, so that they themselves may become masters, roshi, thoroughly versed in all the skillful means, upaya, for teaching Zen to others. Like so many other things of this kind, the system is as good as one makes it, and its graduates are both tall Buddhas and short Buddhas. It should not be assumed that a person who has passed a koan, or even many koan, is necessarily a transformed human being whose character and way of life are radically different from what they were before. Nor should it be assumed that satori, enlightenment, is a single, sudden leap from the common consciousness to complete, unexcelled awakening. Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. Satori really designates the sudden and intuitive way of seeing into anything, whether it be remembering a forgotten name or seeing into the deepest principles of Buddhism. One seeks and seeks, but one cannot find. One then gives up, and the answer comes by itself. Thus, there may be many occasions of satori in the course of training, great satori and little satori. And the solution of many of the koan depends upon nothing more sensational than a kind of knack for understanding the Zen style of handling Buddhist principles. To the normal Asian concept of the master-pupil relationship, Zen adds something of its own in the sense that it leaves the formation of the relationship entirely to the initiative of the pupil. The basic position of Zen is that it has nothing to say, nothing to teach. The truth of Buddhism is so self-evident, so obvious, that it is, if anything, concealed by explaining it. Therefore, the master does not help the student in any way, since helping would actually be hindering. On the contrary, he goes out of his way to put obstacles and barriers in the student's path. The preliminary Hoshin type of koan begins, therefore, to obstruct the student by sending him off in the direction exactly opposite to that in which he should look. Only it does it rather cleverly, so as to conceal the stratagem. Everyone knows that the Buddha nature is within oneself, and is not to be sought outside, so that no student would be fooled by being told to seek it by going to India or by reading a certain sutra. On the contrary, he is told to look for it in himself. Worse still, he is encouraged to seek it with the whole energy of his being, never giving up his quest by day or night, whether actually in zazen or whether working or eating. He is encouraged, in fact, to make a total fool of himself, to whirl around and around like a dog trying to catch up with its own tail. Commonly, then, a first koan given to a student might be Hui Neng's original face, Chao Chu's Wu, or Hakuin's one hand. At the first San Zen interview, the Roshi instructs the reluctantly accepted student to discover his original face, or aspect, that is, his basic nature, as it was before his father and mother conceived him. When the beginning koan is Chao Chu's Wu, the student is asked to find out why Chao Chu answered Wu, or none, to the question, does a dog have the Buddha nature? The Roshi asks to be shown this nothing. A Chinese proverb says that a single hand does not make a clap. And therefore, Hakuin asks, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Can you hear what is not making a noise? Can you get any sound out of this one object which has nothing to hit? Can you get any knowledge of your own real nature? What an idiotic question! By such means, the student is at last brought to a point of feeling completely stupid, as if he were encased in a huge block of ice, unable to move or think. He just knows nothing. After some time in this state, there comes a moment when the block of ice suddenly melts, when this vast lump of unintelligibility comes instantly alive. The problem of who or what it is becomes transparently absurd, a question which, from the beginning, meant nothing whatever. There is no one left to ask himself the question or to answer it. In this state, the Roshi needs only a single look at the student to know that he is now ready to begin his Zen training in earnest.
Please fast forward to the end and turn the tape over for proper cueing of side two.